Thank you, Jerry. Joe Conroy, alcoholic.
Hello.
Thank you, everybody, for reading, everybody for showing up. It's pretty cool. You all get your sobriety date. My sobriety date is January 1st of 1989. Yeah, yeah. What a crowd. Pretty cool. So I keep thinking this is Saturday. I don't know why it's Friday. I'm all screwed up. Me and my buddy Joe came up here from San Diego yesterday, and then we're leaving late Sunday night, so we rented a car and drove through the woods, and there's a lot of woods up here. I'm having such a great time already. Let me tell you a little story. This is what it was just before I got sober, and there's a lot of country folk up here, so it seems like it's an old Irish poem. It's not very long. It was the pig fair last September, the day I well remember. I was walking up and down the streets in drunken pride when my knees began to flutter and I fell down in the gutter and a pig came up and laid down by my side. As I laid there in the gutter thinking words I could not utter, I thought I'd heard a passing lady say, "You can tell the man who boozes by the company that he chooses." And with that, the pig got up and walked away. That was pretty much my life, actually, and I want to thank Holland for doing that. Bill Cleveland, my buddy Bill down in L.A., was supposed to be here. He actually had a liver put in a couple of weeks ago. He had a liver. He'd been waiting one for quite a while, and I chatted with him the other day. He says, "I'm doing pretty good. Tell everybody up there I love him, I owe him, and I want to come back up there when I'm in much better shape." Just before I got up here, I got a little email. My good buddy Cliff Roach passed away a week ago Wednesday, if you know Cliff, and there's a memorial for him on April 30th. Wonderful obituary in the paper about him, just a wonderful obituary and a great mention of Alcoholics Anonymous, so it was really kind of cool. And I'm up here with a couple of people that I really adore and a couple of people I'm really looking forward to hearing, and I just love being sober. And if you're new, how many people are under a year of sobriety here? If you just raise your hand real quick, because I want to welcome you all here, you know. I think it's very, very cool, and I was listening to Pat. I was in tears this morning listening to Pat tell her story, because I think when we share what we were like, what happened, what we're like now, it really has a great impact on the soul. You know, a lot of people talk about what it's like, what happened, what it's like now, because that's what they hear other people say, "I'm going to share what it's like." But in the big book, it says we share what we are like, what happened, and what we are like now. And if I turn the we into me, I'm going to talk about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I'm going to talk about the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, hopefully. I'm not going to talk about the material stuff, the thing I should have, and if I had that, I'd feel better, because I don't suffer from a material malady. I suffer from a spiritual malady. And that's, I think, the biggest thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that the biggest thing you're going to get is sobriety. And if you don't want sobriety, you're going to be really disappointed with Alcoholics Anonymous. Really, I hope you guys get that, because that's it. You know, just the fact that I'm up here talking and the other people come up here talking doesn't mean that we're super sober or anything like that. We're just asked to do this, and sometimes it's a big pain in the butt to do this. But other times there's going to be a reason, and I don't know who it is or what it is that reason is. My job is just to say yes. What? Where? Where the hell is Seaside? Seaside? Yeah, just fly up to Portland and then drive another 2 hours through the woods. You'll be fine. I'm like, wow, you know. I got that little Deliverance song going through my head, because we were at night, and it was fun, but it was like, I just love being sober, you know, because sometimes you go places where you never believe you're going to be. Pat reminded me of a story, and this together we can is a huge thing. I hope you guys get this. I hope you understand what we're talking, because it's not about me, it's about us. A couple of years back, I was working over in Hong Kong, and I forget where I was going to go all of a sudden. Oh, so there's a mountain in Hong Kong, right? There's great recovery in Hong Kong, believe it or not. There's really good, there's great recovery everywhere you go. All you got to do is find it. But I was like, there's a huge mountain. That's not a huge mountain. There's a big hill in Hong Kong. And I was at the time trying to get physical. I was trying to lose weight. And I'm still trying to lose weight. I keep finding it. Jesus, a place like this is crazy. We had breakfast at 8, and then we ate again at 11:30, and then Holland's going, "We're going to eat again at 4:30. Is that okay?" I go, "God, I'm already blowing out of my pants. I can't eat anymore." I go, "What are we having for dinner?" "Oh, my God, that sounds like good. You know, can we get a snack later?" this is who you got right now at 2:30. So where was I? So I was kind of, I says, I'm going to get a little physical in Hong Kong. If you've never been to Hong Kong, makes San Francisco look flat. Makes this place look flat. And it's hot. And it's humid. And it's sticky. And I sweat. So I'm up there. I'm gonna go up this hill. You know, you can take a tram, you can take a cab, you can take a bus. But no, I'm going to hike because it looks like a lot of other people are going to hike. So I start hiking up this hill. And I'm starting to sweat. And it's and it just started. I just started going up the hill. And these little Asian people were going by me about 100 miles an hour. You know, hi, how are you? Zoom, and they're going up. And I'm like, holy shit, I'm up against a tree. And I'm sweating. I'm going, how am I going to do this? And I kept looking all the way up. And I start to, and I'm wearing a gray shirt, T-shirt. And gray really shows out the sweat. So it's just kind of, you could see it coming down. And then it's like, the more I'm walking, the more I'm sweating, and it's getting hotter, and that hill is getting higher and higher, and I just keep going, and I see these people flying by me, these old people flying by me, and I'm up against a rock and a tree, and I'm going, Jesus, I'm never going to make it. And after about an hour, these people start coming down, the same people that already passed me going up, and I'm going, what is going on? So I finally make it to the top, and there's restaurants, there's trinket shops, there's all this stuff, and I was drenched, just drenched, and I got to the top and it's cold because the wind's blowing. Now I'm getting chilly, so I have to buy a T-shirt. So I go in to buy a T-shirt, and it's all in Mandarin or Cantonese. I have no idea. It was Chinese to me. And I have no idea what I was. So I says, I want that on the wall. It looked good, so I bought it, right? And I said, can I change this? I want to get rid of it. So I took my old shirt off, and I went in the back and put the new one on, and I threw the old one out. And I said to the woman, what does this mean? She says, don't give up. I went, whoa, and I started laughing. She says, what's so funny? I said, you have no idea. You have no idea. But I think that's what you were talking about, Pat. Don't give up, you know. You know, this is just a great fellowship of men and women that share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. That's what we do here. That's all I'm doing up here today, you know. I got sober in 89. My sobriety day, I took my last drink on New Year's Eve, 1989. I'd moved out from Boston. I grew up in Boston and moved out in right after Thanksgiving, 1989. I got 12-stepped in a bar. I attended a bar in Boston, and I had a really bad problem one night, and I admitted to a guy that was sober member. It was a comedy club, and he ran this comedy club, and all his comedians were sober, and it was just, like, overwhelming for me. I was a sad drunk. I wasn't a bad drunk. I was a sad drunk. But I absolutely loved drinking. But when I attended bar, I didn't like to drink behind the bar, because I would lose control. And you don't want to, I was in the city of Boston, it was just, I never liked to lose control. And this for one night, I was losing control. I was literally drinking behind the bar, and I was running back into the chest to get cases of beer, to fill up the cases out front, and it was really just because I had lines of cocaine lined out in the back there, because it was all kind of coming in on top of me. And it was just really overwhelming. And it was, the drinking had just got to the point where I could not not drink. I could not not drink, and I'm the type of drink, when I wasn't working, I was the type of drunk that used to drink inside my house to go out and get drunk. I was so riddled with fear. It was just an amazing thing for me. I would sit there and I lived in this three-room flat. I'll get back to the other story in a minute, hopefully. Sometimes I go off and I can't figure out where I was. And where was I? I was in a three-room flat. So it was, and I used to just sit there and just put on. At the time, I was listening to Willie Nelson's Redheaded Stranger, right? So I had really, really, really long, bushy, curly red hair. Like, obnoxiously long and bushy and curly red hair. Like, really long and bushy. Like, when you would come and meet me, you would go, wow, you got really long and bushy red hair. And I would go, yeah, I know that. I've had it all my life, you know? I prayed for my long and bushy red hair to go away. yeah. So anyway, I'm sitting there listening to the Redheaded Stranger from Blue Rock, Montana, and I would sit there rolling joints so I could go out drinking, and I was drinking this red wine. I lived in an Italian neighborhood, and I used to get this really good wine with a cork, right? So it's got to be good if it's got a cork. Because drunks only drink out of a twist top, right? That makes perfect sense. So I would go down to the corner and get a corked bottle of wine, And then I would do what you were talking about, make some phone calls after a couple of glasses of red. And red wine is not an upper, you know. It kind of makes you a little weepy, you know, in the time, especially when you're listening to Willie Nelson, you know, like, Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain was another one. I would go on with that, and I loved the blues, so I'd be listening to that, and I'd be just like, you'd want to slice my wrist if you came into my house at this time. I said, Jesus, let me get you out of here. This is crazy, you know? That's really the way I would, oh my God. It was just like, so I would call my brother who lives up in Santa Barbara, and I would, you know, I can't, it would just be drama and trauma. And he would say, Joe, do yourself a favor. Put a cork in the bottle and go out and drink. Oh, that sounds like a good idea. So I'd put the cork in the bottle, and I would go out and drink. And now I attended bar in Boston. I knew every bartender in every place, and it was just like, I was like Norm from Cheers. You know, I'd walk in, Joe, you know, ah. You know, and then the goal when you're a bar drinker is for the bartender to have it there when you sit at your chair. You know what I mean? That's like Bill said, I have arrived. It's like, you're just walking in just like real cool and all, and then you see the napkin going down and then the cocktail right on top of it, and you sit down and everybody goes, wow. Yeah. You know, two or three drinks later, they will get out of here. You know, it's like, but that's the way I was, you know. But this one night I'm at the bar and I'm just like, the thought of sobriety had not really been, the thought of sobriety hadn't entered my mind yet. These guys that tended by, the guys, the comedians, they were sober, and I didn't really understand what that was about. I didn't know what that was. And we call this a program of attraction. Not one of those people ever forced anything upon me. But they did something to me that used to be the weirdest thing. They used to watch me. Like, sit at the bar and watch me. Did you ever just been watched? It's the most uncomfortable thing in the world. Well, people just, and I go, what are you guys looking at me for? Well, they would say stuff like, well, you look like you're in trouble. Like, with what? You know, the sweat would be pouring down my face. And it's like, it's not even hot, and I'm not even working. But they could sense something, what was going on. And I would like, it was almost like, they would just open the door just a little bit. And I would come up and ask them something like, you guys don't drink. Why? Well, we don't have time to tell you that, but what we do is we join a program and we try to get some recovery. Ah. So I go back behind the bar, and you can see the tiniest mustard seed. And you get back down, and I get back down to the end of the bar, and I go, that was a weird thing for somebody to say. Now we go back down, wait a minute, no, what? Explain that, what did you mean, like you don't drink, but you're just going to get some recovery, from what? Well, and they would stop telling me some AA stuff. But I didn't understand what it was, so it made me really uncomfortable. And I didn't like them either. That doesn't make any difference. I just didn't like them because I was uncomfortable. So I was so riddled with fear. And then I watched what they did. See, I'm an observer. Even in AA, I'm an observer. I watch what people do. What we say is one thing, but what we do is amazing. You know, you can say, why don't you go up and greet the newcomer, and God damn it, do. But when you watch somebody do it, it's pretty, it's not shame-based. When you watch somebody walk up to somebody's new and shake their hand and welcome them when they don't want to be welcomed, when they don't want to, they're sitting there with their arms crossed or with their hands in their pocket, and somebody walks up and goes, Jesus, it's really good to see you. And they're going, no, I'm not good to be seen. You don't understand. I can't. And they go, thank you. And there's a connection made that quickly. And how many times I've watched, and I've done it myself, I watched new people come into AA and walk out the door and nobody ever says hello to them. You know, it's a tough thing. There's a lot of people in here. We want to get comfortable, but isn't it about, it's about uncovering our uncomfortability and getting through it and finding somebody else that you can help. And when these guys started doing that at that bar, and they started setting the tone for me till I could get to the point where this one night when it was all falling apart, and I turned to the guy that was running this thing, a guy named Dick D, a guy that I could not stand, a guy that is a big comedian still to this day. I couldn't like him, didn't like him now, didn't like him then. I thought he was the biggest boob I ever met, and it was just the most ridiculous club that he ever ran, and I don't know what the hell he's doing. He should have gone back to drinking, and this is crazy that he's sober. Dick, I need your help. This one night I said, Dick, I need your help. And he says, what's wrong? I says, I think I'm an alcoholic. And when you mention to somebody who's in Alcoholics Anonymous that you've got a problem, your world will change. When you say to your friend who you're drinking with, I think I got a problem, they're going to go, you can't have a problem. Why? Because if you have a problem, I have a problem. And I don't have a problem. Oh, Jesus Christ, what was I thinking? You're nuts. Get another beer. Get everybody a drink. But when you say it to somebody who's in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the little cape comes on the other person, right? You know? And then they start, blah, 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 oh my God, this is crazy. This is, blah, blah. And I'm like, wait a minute, I can't understand a thing that's being said. And then he goes, doesn't look like you're understanding the thing I'm saying. He goes, no. And he goes, here, this doesn't work. Let me give you my number. You call me in the morning when you get home. We'll talk about this stuff. Call me in the night, the next day or something. And he gave me my number. And I'm tending bar. And the bar closed in Boston. They close at 1 o'clock. And if you know, if you tend bar, there's usually the doors lock at 1 o'clock. Right? There's a handful of people that are allowed in. And I worked in the combat zone. If you ever read the third tradition, the 12 and 12, it talks about pimps and queers and thieves, and that's who was in my bar late at night. And it was a wonderful place with the doors locked, cops and robbers. And I was a little pissed off tonight. Holland, actually, I don't know if you guys know that he turned off the stripper pole light down the bottom here. That light was on here, and it's off now, right? Is it on? It's been back on? Sorry about that. That was going to be, he turned it off earlier. So I worked in this combat zone and all these places and people I wouldn't mix with, but when that bar closed, it mixed and we closed. And then I get home at 6 o'clock in the morning and I'm looking, unloading my pocket, and there was a phone number for Dick. Now I told you what I thought about him. And then it was worse at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm not gonna call this boob. What do I want? I had a little problem. And that was it. That was it. The problem went away. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, I'm out riding my bike in the Charles River, Boston, and I ran into Dick. It was the fall roundup of Alcoholics Anonymous going on. And I didn't know what was going on. I pulled my bicycle up far enough that I could see what was going on, but not so far that you guys could see me. And all of a sudden, I feel this tap on my shoulder, and it was this guy, Dick. Joe, what are you doing here? What do you mean, what am I doing here? Why'd you stop here? I said, what do you mean, why did I stop? You guys are in my way. Who are you? What are you doing here? He said, well, this is the fall roundup of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh. What's that mean? Ah, it's just a sobriety celebration. How you doing with that problem? My problem. Remember you had that little problem that night? Wow! It just denied it. And thank God he went on and told me his story. He didn't tell me what to do, what I needed to do, what I should do, nothing. He stood there and told me his story. And it was boring. All right? It was not exciting. It was an intrusive into my space. And I'm listening to this guy, and I'm thinking about getting away. And I mean getting away. And I literally packed my bags the next day, and I drove to California to get away. Because it was over. And I came out here to California to be discovered, uncovered, discarded, who knows what it was, but it was like, you know, I was going to be a surfer, I was going to become a comedian, I was going to become a famous musician. It didn't happen, you know. I remember on January 1st, 1989, oh, Dick said something, there'll come a time, after he did all his spiel, he said, Joe, there'll come a time if you're done with drinking, you have some power greater than yourself for help, you'll never have to take another drink as long as you live. That was the icing on the cake. That was like the no way. I want nothing. And on January 1st, 1989, I'm sitting in a little flop house in downtown San Diego because I was living in my car, and I didn't want to live in the car on New Year's Eve. I wanted to get a house. I wanted to get a place, and it was $19.95. Downtown San Diego 28 years ago was a ghetto. It was pretty much a ghetto. There's a couple of people from San Diego here. Not a full-fledged ghetto, but it was not very pretty. It's really pretty now and really expensive and way too many people. And I live there, and they're in my way, and I don't like them most of the time. But I'm at the little flop house, and on January 1st, 1989, I'm writing a journal at the time because that was when Robert Bly, do you remember Robert Bly? Men's going out in the woods and beating drums and getting naked and doing whatever. I don't know. It was so everybody was writing journals. I was journaling, and I said, in my journal on New Year's Day, I said, my God, I'm an alcoholic. And then I wrote the three words that I look at every once in a while. I still have the journal. I said, I need help. I wish I could tell you that was like Bill wind blowing through the windows and just an icy, it was like, oh, wow. This is it, huh? Wow. I guess I won't drink no more. What do I do? So I called Jerry, my brother up in Santa Barbara. Dude, he called me dude. Dude, I was wondering when this might happen. Let me put my wife on the phone. Little did I know that she was an Alateen when she was a kid. She was really nice until she got on that phone that day. And it was really probably the most profound thing I ever heard somebody say. And you'll hear it a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. Get in the car. Get in the car. And she says, get up here. I said, what am I going to do? Just get in the car. Get up here. Get up here. What's going to happen? Get in the car, Joe. And I was driving a 63 Ford Falcon station wagon. And San Diego to Santa Barbara on a good day in a good car will take you 4.5 hours. Good day meaning you leave 3 o'clock in the morning to get through L.A., you know. Good day. And 63 Ford Falcon station wagon with no rear main seal and oil that I used to buy from Pep Boys, used case at a time, and stop and pull over and put the oil in it. And it took a long time. And it just like the journey of my life to AA. And I drove up to Santa Barbara with people giving me the finger because the oil was just, the whole 5 North was just white with, and just with oil smoke and just, you know, and I get up to Santa Barbara and I said, what's going to happen? And she says, we made an appointment with a gentleman down at the central office. It's at 1212 State Street in Santa Barbara. And I went down there and there was a guy named Howard. I thought it was an appointment. It's not an appointment. You know, you can walk in any time, you know. And there was a guy named Howard that had 29 years of sobriety, and he sat in the chair and he rocked. And he said, tell me what's going on. And I told him what was going on, and I didn't know what I said. And then he told me his story, and he was a Marine by, no, I mean, he just retired as a captain of a Shell oil ship, a boat, what do you call him? He was a merchant marine. And I was pissed off. Because I always wanted to be a merchant marine. I would always say, how can I become a captain? They go, well, you have to go to school. To be a captain? I'm not going to school. And he pissed me off because he did all that stuff. And he said, I just retired after 29 years of sobriety. And this is really cool. Tell me what's going on. I told him what was going on. And I wanted him to just stamp me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Just give me the badge, you know. Give me this. He said, I don't know if I'm you're an alcoholic, Joe. I know I'm an alcoholic. I know the people coming in and out of here to buy books are alcoholic. I know everybody around here that I know are alcoholics. Are you an alcoholic? He says, I think I'm an alcoholic. He said, good. You got to go to a meeting. And he said, you look like you're riddled with fear. I didn't know what that meant. You look like you're riddled with fear. He says, you should just go to some speaker meetings because then you can just sit there and you can kind of absorb what's being said. This is a good speaker meeting down here tonight. Go to that and see what happens. And I did. And nothing really happened. My brother Jerry took me. Now, Jerry's a year older than me. Jerry's not an alcoholic. He's kind of a goofball, and he's kind of sensitive. And we're in this meeting, and I'm sitting there with my arms crossed because I just couldn't stand what was being said, and he was crying because he thought it was just the greatest thing he's ever heard in his life. And I'm like, this is ridiculous, Jerry. He goes, this is great. Dude, you got a good life ahead of you. And I'm like... And I was just miserable. And then we're sitting there, and they go, okay, let's circle up like what happened this morning. Let's circle up. And me and Jerry are sitting there, had no idea what circle up meant. So we're watching everybody leave. You know, we get up, and they're all, come on, dude, get up here. So we get up there and grab everybody's hands. And then they start saying the Lord's Prayer. And Jerry starts bawling like a girl. And I'm standing there going, oh. And it was just like, but something happened at that moment when we did this at the circle. Something happened at that exact moment when we shook hands, when we touched, when one alcoholic literally touches another alcoholic. There's something that I think is a physical connection. I don't know if that's why we shake hands. I don't know if that's why we hug. I don't know if it's a why, but there's something that really happens that envelops us and brings us into Alcoholics Anonymous that we don't want. Because we come in here with our arms down, with our arms crossed, our arms, eyes down, don't touch me, don't look at me, I don't want nothing you folks have, really just stay away from me. And then somebody comes up and goes, hi. Hi. And you don't know what's going on. You don't know how to answer the question. You don't really, because you're just so full of fear. Fear is an evil and a corroding thread. The very fabric of its life is shot through with us. It's shot through our soul. And we drank to get rid of that fear so we could perform. And you're asking me to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and say something? Holy Christ. It's torture. You know it's torture. If you're new, if you're coming into Alcoholics Anonymous new right now, you know how hot it is, and you've got an ego that is just overwhelming. Your ego is driving you here. It's driving you here, and then you walk in, and you want to sit down, and then you want them to call on you. You want all this sort of stuff, but it's just not going to happen. I would walk into meetings and just go, God damn it, the same people are going to share. I know that. They're going to call on the same people tonight, and they're going to say the same stupid thing. And they're going to, oh, my God. And then I go to a speaker meeting, and it's the same person I heard a while ago. God dang it, isn't there anybody else around? Why don't they ever ask me to get up and do this stuff? I got some stuff that can really share about. Why don't they call on me when I go to these meetings? Please, why don't they do that? Jesus, it's ridiculous. How about the guy over there? Joe, would you like to share? Oh, no, I've got nothing. No, no. Oh, no, 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 I'm fine, I'm fine. No, I'm fine. I pass. No, I'm good. You know, and then you just go, oh. And then the first time you do that stuff, and somebody comes up to you and they go, oh, my God, what you said just saved my life. That's called identification. If you're sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous, not being yourself, not giving yourself, not being of 100% maximum service, you're giving a big disservice to AA. You're giving a big disservice to you. Because you want to come in here and be in the spotlight of the Spirit. Everybody does. I don't live in the spotlight. This feels like it's the spotlight of the Spirit sometimes. But it's the sunlight of the Spirit that we're supposed to be living in. And sunlight helps things grow. It helps people that are little seedlings grow into big, magnificent alcoholics people. You know, and if they come in here and we just don't give them this great message of hope, they're going to get a message of dope. You know, it's my responsibility as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous to make sure that every meeting I go to stays on message. You know, if I'm not hearing, my friend Diana, she got sober when she was 14. She used to go, I go to nothing but AA meetings now. And she said, I've gone to an awful lot of AB meetings since I've been sober. And people go, what the hell's an AB meeting? She goes, I don't know, but it ain't an AA meeting. And you've been to a lot of AB meetings. AB meetings don't usually last because they don't practice the traditions that you talked about. You know, they don't look at the concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't have service entities. They don't have leaders. That's one of the biggest things we miss in AA is leadership. It's great. If you ever want to read something really exciting, now the concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous are probably the most torturous thing you could ever read in your life. But there's one concept, concept 9. If you read Concept 9, Bill has a little essay, and it's called Leadership in AA. It's about a page and a half, two and a half page. I forget how long it is. But I think it's one of the best things that Bill Wilson ever wrote. And it's about being sponsors. It's about being leaders. It's about being GSRs. It's about being secretaries. It's about being responsible for sobriety and responsible for the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous so it can grow and keep on growing. And I think that's really a big, big thing that we do in here. You know, I see you guys up here. There's like a passion. When we got in here this morning, it was like, Jesus, I didn't expect this. I didn't expect this in Seaside, Oregon. Why? You know, because our mind goes, it's not going to work. I didn't expect to find AA in Hong Kong. But I did. I remember I went to an AA meeting in Shanghai. This was several years back too, and I'm sitting in a meeting, and in Shanghai in China, it's a little different now. When AA first started, they could not have meetings like you guys are having. It was considered a religious thing. So the government forbid them. So what people used to do is they used to rent rooms in hotels. And if there is a room being rented, the government will not enter that domain because they just it's none of their business. So the meeting was held in the Ritz-Carlton, which is odd, right? It was held in the Ritz-Carlton. And I went to the meeting, and it was a really good meeting, except for the two people that were talking behind me through the whole meeting. Now, I'm from Southern California, and we don't do that's disrespectful. And there's not a goddamn person in this room that's saying anything to these people. I'm a visitor. I'm not going to say anything to these people. But they better shut up pretty quick. Because if they don't, I'm going to have to turn around and say something to them. Because this is not right. I don't care who they are or what they are. This is ridiculous. Would somebody please tell them to shut up? Jesus Christ, I'm going to have to do this myself. And I turned around to tell them to shut up. And there was this big Norwegian blonde-haired guy, 6 foot 5 inches tall. Interpreting Mandarin. And I just melted. I went, oh, you're an asshole, Joe. And I'm just like watching this, and it was so surreal. And this person that didn't speak English was beaming. Was beaming. And I'm going, oh, you are such a jerk. And then he wanted to share. Oh, God. And all he was grateful that we were there. Oh, you're such a jerk. But it was some sort of delusion that needed to be smashed inside of me. Some sort of thing that I needed to believe that I had to let go of. And it was really, I had to go all the way to Shanghai for that? Couldn't you have done it right in San Diego? But sometimes the ego is like, Dr. Tebow, if you guys are struggling with ego, Dr. Tebow is great stuff. Dr. Tebow was one of the first alcoholic trustees, and he was a psychiatrist. He says, the ego has amazing recuperative powers. Amazing recuperative powers. Doesn't matter how long you're sober. It'll sneak back in. It'll sneak back in, and it'll start taking over, all this sort of stuff. So it's a constant surrender over and over and over again, and it really is. It's just it's the beautiful thing of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's not magic. If this deal was magic, anybody could teach you the trick. It's mysterious. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic it's not therapeutically correct. How does that work? How does that work? Doctors and physicians spend thousands on people, hours and money and time to get them sober. And you get one boob, then one phone call to central office, and one boob shows up, and he goes, you want some help? I go to AA. Let me tell you my story. Can you just imagine what it was like when Bill showed up to Bob at first? You know, Bob's underneath the table at and then he shows up to Bob, and Bob had been praying for something. He wanted something bigger than better than Bill W. from New York. He knows nothing, and something happened. Bill started telling his story to Bob, and Bob started to identify. And then they went off and found Bill D. number 3. Bill D. number 3 was full of contempt prior to investigation. He's sitting in the hospital beating up nurses and just like strapped down. And his wife said, there are a couple of guys from AA coming. They're boobs. They don't know what they're talking about. And they sat at the edge of the bed, and Bill D. got it because they were telling their story. We tell our story to help somebody else. We don't go in and tell their story. We don't go in and tell them what to do. We go in and tell them what we did. That's the mystery of AA. It's just like if I could tell you how to do this thing. You know, Bill calls it indescribably wonderful because it's indescribable. It's like, how does this make sense? There's how many people in here? I don't know. And is there anybody going to get anything out of it? I don't know. It's not my job to figure that out. My job is to show up and just kind of carry a message. Somebody sitting in here might be sitting next to somebody, and that somebody next to them is like angry and pissed off, and they're not hearing anything. And then somebody else is laughing hysterically, and they're looking at each other going, are you at the same meeting I am? You know, because sometimes we get so consumed with self that all we can see is the problem. And that's what, if we can, in AA, I think all it does is literally
sometimes figuratively goes like this.
Ah, my buddy TJ from the Bronx, I'll never forget him. First time I met him, because I was like this. He goes, Conroy, Jesus Christ, take these and put them down by your side. I go, what? He goes, you're so tense. Sometimes we're on the offensive. Just like sometimes, have you ever called your sponsor? You've got a problem, and you've got the answer already, right? But I'm going to call him because he wants me to call him. And you get on the phone, and it's like, well, I don't know. My sponsor is Ken Devaney, if you know Ken. Ken is not rule, he is rule 62. He doesn't take anything serious at all. And he's been sober almost 47 years. His sponsor is sober 47 years. But he came into AA in 1947. He had 8 years of sobriety. He had a slip for 2 months, had 13 years of sobriety, had a slip for 2 months. Now he's got 47 years of sobriety. Last November, he turned 100 years old. Goes to 3 or 4 meetings a week on a walker. We got a lot of Navy guys that come to meetings, and they'll call on Bob every once in a while. And Bob will go, yeah, I just turned 100 years old back in November. You see the reaction from these kids. They go, did you just say 100? They go, yeah, you know, and they're 18. And then he says, I've been on Social Security longer than most of you people in here have been alive. That really pisses everybody off. And he has no intention of getting off Social Security either. That's what I love about AA. There was a guy that out of Orange County. I can't remember his name now. I used to listen to tapes all the time, and he used to say, listen to the music of AA till you can understand the words. Some of the most profound things are said by speakers, and it's just like, not everybody's going to get it, but listen to the music till you understand the words. I just like, because the music of AA is just wonderful. Just before a meeting starts, it's just, if you were here just before I got up here, it was just loud. It was noisy. It was seemed like it was uncontrollable. It was just out of, it was just like nuts. And all of a sudden it just, boom, it's quiet. I think the quiet is the identification. Some of the best meetings I've ever gone to is when somebody is really getting down to causes and conditions, really getting down to emotional sobriety. The room is stunningly quiet. When somebody is up here or in your other meeting or wherever it is and they're sharing opinions and they're sharing attitude and they're just like trying to impress you, the meeting is loud. It's very, people are getting up to pee, they're getting up to get coffee, they're texting, ha ha ha, you know, they're doing all those, but they're just not listening because what's happening is they're not identifying with that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body where they can recover from that seemingly hopeless state. It's a great gift. You know, I love the fact that this is not about perfection. One of the best books I ever read about some sort of AA history is The Spirituality of Imperfection, written by a guy named Ernest Kurtz. I don't know if the guy has it out there. I didn't look. Ernie died a couple of years ago. He wasn't sober when he first wrote his first book, which is Not God, which is a wonderful thesis and a great history of AA. But he ended up in AA at the end, and he was just a great historian. He was given access to AA, one of the few people that were given access to the archives, the vault, as they say in New York, where all the seedy information is, you know. He just had to write a sign of things says you're not gonna admit to a lot of some of the things that are in here, you know. Everybody wants the dirt. Tell us the dirt. Who cares about the dirt? You know, we all have dirt. We all have stuff. But being sober right here, right now, is the best thing that can ever happen to you. If you're new and you're struggling with AA, tell somebody before you drink. Sometimes people go out and drink at AA. You know, and then somebody will say, well, did you do everything? Yeah, I did everything. Did you share everything? Yeah, I shared everything. Everything? Well, no. I could have shared one more thing. I could have done one more thing. I could have gone to one more meeting. I could have not said one more thing. And it's not about the bad. It's about not giving up around here. It's about that, I believe. It's just because it's a beautiful way of life. It's a wonderful way of life that just takes time. That's the one thing about AA that a lot of people don't understand. You know, it takes a year to get a year sober. It takes 5 years to get 5 years sober. It takes 20 years to get 20 years sober. Why can't you give me an app? Wouldn't it be so much easier if I just had an app? You know, yeah, you got an app. It's called Sponsee. What? Because that's going to rocket you into that fourth dimension of existence. I'll never forget the first guy that asked me to sponsor him. Tom Higgins passed away 17 years ago this last month. He was the first guy that ever asked me to sponsor him. I'll never forget it. I was at a beginner's meeting in Mission Hills in San Diego, and he was sitting on this chair and on this table, and he was shaking his legs, and he says, "Hey, can I talk to you for a second?" I said, "Sure. Will you sponsor me?" Oh, I thought I was, it was almost like when you pick up a baby for the first time. Oh, Jesus Christ, what? I can't do that. I'll hurt you. You know, it's like, because it's like you just, your whole mind just goes, oh my God, no, don't do that. You know, and I'll never forget, we sponsored each other. I think we really did sponsor each other because it was just a wonderful relationship. Tom was an angry, angry, angry atheist. Angry atheist. He was HIV positive, full-blown AIDS, little gay kid, screamer, angry, pain in the ass, just a pain in the ass. And I'll never forget the time I said, "Hey, I'm going to go up to Montreal for a vacation. You want to go?" He said, "Sure." And I love going to churches when I go away. I love to go visit a church. And up in Montreal, there's a big church called the Notre Dame. It's a fake Notre Dame or something. I don't know what you call it. But it's a church, and I wanted to go to the church, right? So we go in there, and Tom goes in with me, which I thought was kind of weird, you know, because he's an angry atheist. And we're in there, and he's probably about 6 or 7 years sober at the time. And we're walking around, and I'm just quick. That's good. I'm done. I'm going to go have a smoke. He goes, "Go ahead. Can I stay in here for a minute?" I said, "Sure." So he stayed in there for a minute, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. Jesus Christ, is he ever going to come out? And then he came out, and he was walking down the front steps, and I'm looking at him. I says, "What's wrong with you?" And he said, "I don't know." "What do you mean you don't know?" He said, "Something happened in there." I said, "What?" He said, "I don't know." "What are you talking about?" He goes, "I was in there watching you going around and looking at all these statues and all this gold and all this glitter and all this, and you were really enjoying it. And then I started watching everybody else. And they were really believing what they were looking at." And I said, "Oh my God, who am I to judge them?" I went, "What?" He goes, "I want them to believe what I believe. I thought they were making me believe what they believe." He goes, "I'm crazy." And from that point to the end of his life, he never was angry again because he identified. And that was it. And he asked me to pull the plug. And that was tough. I said, "Why me?" He said, "Because you're the only one I trust." He says, "I don't want to live in pain." And when it came time, the doctor came up and said, "Joe, it's time." And I went, "No." He goes, "All I'm asking you to do is say yes. Because that's all he wanted you to do." I went, "Oh my God." And he passed away peacefully. It was the most beautiful experience I ever had. Up until my buddy Mike. You're going to hear Georgia talk about time. My best friend Mike. I was diagnosed with AIDS in 97. I was diagnosed with AIDS out of the blue. I had been HIV positive for years, and I didn't even know it. And I got to the point where I had to go to the VA, and I was on my deathbed. I walked to the VA on my eighth birthday, 1997. I was 8 years sober. I was taken to the VA by Tom because I had just been diagnosed with pneumocystis pneumonia. And they said to me, "How long have you been HIV positive?" I said, "I had no idea I was HIV positive." And they said, "You're very, very sick." And I go, "I know." And I said, I turned into this super sober guy for just a little bit. I said, "Doc, I've been sober for 8 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard people always talk about surrender, and I don't think I've ever understood it until this very moment. I absolutely want to live more than I want to die. And I surrender to this. Help me. And she goes, it's going to be a big deal. And it was a really big deal. It was an incredibly big deal. So together, we are one. I remember sitting at home. They sent me home, and I was delusional for about 6 months. And I had no money and nothing. I was recovering in my home. And the guys from the meeting used to come over, and they used to put food in my refrigerator. And I didn't know they were in the house. And they used to wash my clothes. And I didn't know they were in the house. And it was really weird, because I remember going to the meeting. I had called my sponsor the day after I got diagnosed. I said, Boss, I'm dying. And he goes, you can't die. I'm giving you a cake on Friday night. And I went and I gave him a cake. They gave me a cake on Friday night. And it was just, I walked into the room and this guy said, Joe, you look terrible. I said, let me tell you what my week was like. And I told this one guy, and he sat down, and I sat down in my back row with my arms crossed, but don't touch me, leave me alone. And all of a sudden, he started telling the guy next to him, who was telling the guy next to him, who was telling the guy next to him. And all of a sudden, the whole room, now I don't like being in the spotlight, and the whole room is looking at me. And you know when that happens. And I got up and I took a cake, and Mike had been in the room that night. My buddy Mike had just been diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, and he had just moved to San Diego from Las Vegas. And I got up and took the cake, and I said, listen, I'm in a really bad way. I don't understand what's going to happen to me for the rest of my life. And then Mike came up to me, and Mike used to talk like this. My name is Mike. Mike says, Joe, I just got diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. And immediately, the thing that saves one alcoholic with another alcoholic is identification. And it was like, he says, it's going to be okay. And we together traveled the road till he passed away. He passed away a happy, joyous, and free man. Absolutely happy, joyous, and free. Nothing can keep you separated from God except your own old ideas. And me and Mike, I used to drive him up to Clancy's meeting on Wednesday night. I didn't like going to the Clancy's meeting, and I used to drive Mike every night. And I go, why do you make me drive you up here? Because I want Clancy to kiss me on the top of the head. Mike was in a wheelchair, and Clancy used to come up and kiss him on the top of the head every Wednesday night. And if that's what you want, that's what you're going to get in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was willing to do that. It was just some of the most spiritual moments we had in our life. Like the moment with Tom was a spiritual awakening. Spiritual awakenings was when I walked to the top of the hill and I said to the woman, what does that mean? She says, don't give up. Your spiritual awakening happens little bits at a time. They're not huge emotional displacements, but they're emotional displacements. They're displacements from here to here, from the head to the heart, from academic to experiential. This will get you in serious trouble. This is just the magic magnifying mind that Dr. Paul used to, because it's just wild. When I started talking about when you call your sponsor, I've got this problem, and he immediately takes you out of the problem, takes you out of your head and starts getting you down into your heart. Your sponsor is just like, some of the guys, they'd call me and the conversation used to start like this. Oh, boy. I'd pick up the phone and that was the first thing I hear. You're there. Oh, Jesus. So I would actually have Vivaldi Four Seasons queued up on my CD player and I would hang on a sec. I turn that thing on. Oh, you gonna listen to me? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Did you do any inventory before you called me? Did you get what's going on up here out of there and put it on a piece of paper so I can help you find the solution? Ah, no, I want you to do it for me. I don't have the time like I do, you know? And that really is, sometimes you have to, I don't think it's tough. It's not love. It's experience. I don't know what tough love is, you know, but experiential love is really, okay, stop. Oh, will you really? Let's get down to causes and conditions. Let's get it out of your head so I can get it into your heart so you can help somebody else. Like you were saying. It is always about helping somebody else. Oh my God, it's always about that. And the sicker you are, the more people you have to help. The sicker you are, the more people will come up to you and go, I need your help, you know. Oh, come on, not you too. No, it's crazy. I got the time. You know, and then some people go, how many people do you sponsor? And they always say, one at a time. What do you mean by that? I go, I only sponsor one at a time. How many do you sponsor? I have no idea. I can only really help one at a time. I can get them in groups and they hate each other. You know, it's like, I'm not going to compete them with others. But one at a time, and they're all different. Jesus, I got a whack group of whack jobs, don't I, Joe? Oh, my God, this is just some, and it's eclectic group, you know. They all look fine on the outside, but boy, oh, boy. There's some tick-tocking going on the inside. There's some crazy stuff being said, you know. I love it. Hey, I'm thinking that I might want to, you know, really. You lost me at thinking, kid. You lost me at thinking. It's just great stuff, you know. I think she's really ready. For what? I don't know. I don't know, really. This she's and this he's. There's some madness that goes on. And for the longest time, Ken used to always say to me, he says, how come you're alone? I go, oh, my God, look at the whack jobs I sponsor. They all have problems with relationships. He goes, well, what about you? Why don't you get one? Wow, I'm not good enough for that. That's one of the old ideas I didn't want to ever let go of. What do you mean you're not good enough for that? Ken, I don't want to talk about it. He goes, what I want you to do is write an inventory. Oh, I don't have the time. He said, why don't you take a weekend and go to Palm Springs? Oh, what a great idea. I remember I went to Palm Springs, and I went to the hotel, and I started writing, and I was writing, and I was writing, and I was writing. And I called him up. I said, Ken, I'm done. And I came home, he says, let's do this. We did a fifth step. And he sat there, and I was just puked out some stuff that was just ridiculous. And he goes, Joe, if I know an awful lot of people that know you and love you, not one of them has ever said about you what you wrote down on that piece of paper. I went, what? He goes, the perception you have of yourself is absolutely wrong. Absolutely wrong. He said, you gotta really continue to work on steps 6 and 7 to get rid of these old ideas that you have of yourself that are blocking you from having true relationships, like emotional good relationships with people. Because I was like, on the outside, pretty good, but on the inside, just kind of lonely. And I think a lot of us do that in here. We use AA. We use this sometimes. I would use this as a shield rather than a mirror. This helps me look at myself, but I was using it to keep people away from me. And I don't do that anymore. I try not to do that anymore. I try to be of love and service. Page 77 in that book says we fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and those about us. Maximum service is that maximum is a big word. It's not a little word. Maximum is different for me than it might be for you. But it's maximum service. How willing are you to go? How far are you willing to go? Any length is a long way. It can be a long way. And the longest way we have is from the head to the heart. From experiential to academic, or the other way around. It's just like, if I live in this thing, I create a massive problem that nobody can help me uncover or discover or discard. And when I do those inventories, and I go to my sponsor with it, and he goes, just get away with that stuff and move on with your life. I think that's being rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. That's why I think this together we are one is really, really powerful statement. Because it is one alcoholic working with another alcoholic becomes one alcoholic if you look at it. It becomes one alcoholic. Identification means there's one. Your sponsor-sponsee relationship means there's one person that's going to help you get rocketed into that fourth dimension of existence. I started working with a new, brand newcomer on Tuesday. Had lunch with him, and he was telling me what he was going to do to get better. And I said, you got sober when? He said, Sunday morning. And I go, do me a favor. Slow down. One of the biggest things, the best things I can do for you is so we can develop a relationship first, and that's called trust. There's a great pamphlet called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I'll shut up. And it talks about there come a time in every alcoholic's life when they have to sit down with their enemies, and they're going to realize their enemy is one. It's themselves. It's that deep down inside there's a tiger lurking. And Bill talked about deep down inside is the fundamental idea of God, but it's covered up by pomp and circumstances and worship of other things. And I think those are the tigers. Those are the old ideas that we don't want people to know about. Because if I just keep pushing them down, oh, they keep coming up, and oh, I just keep pushing them down. And if you can keep pushing them down, you'll grow, but you won't get rocketed into that fourth dimension of existence I believe in. And there come a time when you can actually share those things. And it's really a wonderful thing, Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you find that here. If you don't find it in this conference, if you don't find it in your meeting at home, find it somewhere. You know, don't blame Alcoholics Anonymous for your seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Don't blame any. Get rid of the word blame from your speech and thought and be responsible for your recovery. If you're responsible for your recovery, you're never disappointed. If I'm responsible for somebody else to give me recovery, I'll be always, always disappointed. If you're not in here seeking P-E-A-C-E, peace of mind, you're looking for the other peace, that peace is going to get up and walk away from you when you overuse it. It's going to go. But if you find P-E-A-C-E and you live in this moment, right here and right now, you'll never, ever, ever be disappointed with AA, with your recovery, with your sponsor, with your job. Everything will seem to kind of work out well. But if you're expecting big things to happen, they'll happen, but not in a big way. If you don't expect anything, everything will happen. Everything will be brand new. Everything. Like the moment is really quick. And we just stretch them together into a beautiful day and a beautiful year, 20, 30, 40 years, and everybody's like, I think that is called the joy of living that the 12-step talks about. But action is the key word. Everybody misses the action. Everybody misses the word action. I want the joy of living. I want the job. I want the car. I want the stuff. But I'm not willing to do that. I wanted to be a merchant marine, but I wasn't willing to do those. I want to be 185 pounds, but I'm not willing to do the work to get to 185 pounds. My expectations there are way overboard. So I try a little bit at a time. Me and Georgia were talking about just trying to learn to play the guitar. A half an hour a week. A half an hour a week. Learn to play the piano. A half an hour a week. We want to learn to be virtuosos. That's not what it's about. You just want to learn to play a tune. And that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We learn to play the tune. And all of a sudden we start singing the tune, and then we start rocketing other people into the fourth dimension of existence. When you get one alcoholic and you take them along to this journey, boy, oh boy, it's wonderful. It's absolutely just, it is a thrilling, thrilling moment in my life. If you don't think this deal works, try it. And if you don't think that God will help you, literally all you have to do is ask. Like I said on January 1st, 1989, I need help. And when you say those words, that's the biggest surrender. It is a surrender to win. And when you win, that's what it says. I'm going to go back to what Ken always says. It says, when we read how it works, it says, may you find him when? 90-day sober? May you find him when you're 1 year sober? May you find him when you're two? No, it says, may you find him now. That power, that's, may you find him now. And if you turn the word now around, it spells out the word you've won. So if you find this moment now, and you rocket it into that fourth dimension of existence that Bill talks about, all it is right here and right now. You got it licked. So all you got to do is ask. I am looking forward to the rest of the crew that's coming up after me. I have looked forward to coming up here. I am looking forward to taking this clothes jacket off when I get out of here. And it's just because I love being sober. It's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. I hope you guys can find that this weekend. Ciao.